Hello, I'm Dr. Amalia Gonyas-Malka. Welcome to Womanity, Woman in Unity, the show that celebrates women's milestone achievements in their struggle for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, democracy, and much more. Joining us today is Dr. Ilse van der Merwe, who is a counseling psychologist that manages a multidisciplinary private practice which provides psychological, therapeutic, and forensic services, as well as divorce, family mediation, and parent coordination. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. An afternoon to you and your listeners, and thank you for inviting me onto your show, and I'm looking forward to our discussion.
Likewise, we always aim in our conversations and guests that we bring into the show to hear something new. And this is a first for me. We've had several of your colleagues who have been in the clinical psychology space. Could you please tell us about what counseling psychologists do?
I think these days, the clinical and counseling guys do a lot of the same kind of intervention work that is on people not admitted to clinics. And the main difference would be in our internships, where we chose where we would like to focus more on, in which areas. And for the clinical people focused a lot on severe pathologies that are seen in institutions. So people that cannot cope outside their own environments or in their own environments, and then they are admitted to places like Falkenberg or Vescopis or one of those institutions. And then the treatment is also focused treatment, ongoing. And what the counseling psychologist does is focus more on outpatient care, that people that are in their environments and stay in their environment might face a lot of challenges. It might be challenges in their careers or family or relationships or mood within, biological, you know, when you deal with depression as well and anxieties, and how to cope with that and how to get the support to manage these challenges better. So as the counseling psychologist, the idea was to focus on these areas and just to alleviate psychological distress and mental health issues. We also diagnose and we assess and we plan treatment programs for our patients, so the clients. So those are kind of the way that the counseling psychologist works, if that kind of answers your question.
Thanks. And it also shows how you can have one discipline and within it there are so many different facets and niches, with each one having a focus to deal with the specifics of an issue.
We have quite diversity, and we've got a broad range that we can practice within, which I think is brilliant, you know, because we've got, each of us have our strengths and our interests, and I think it really gives you room to focus where you feel you can be best used and where you can serve best. So I do think that makes a big difference.
And speaking about the diversity and breadth of focus, you've got a multidisciplinary practice. Can you tell us at a very high level or top line view of some of the issues that you typically help people address?
Okay, so I think the first thing to start with is obviously the therapeutic side and the therapeutic intervention side. So those are definitely issues that your client comes to you with that they find difficult to cope with. That is very major challenges that actually inhibits their life-to-life coping. And I often find my specialization is more towards mood disorders. So I look a lot at depression and anxiety, which features, unfortunately, quite a lot in society with all the societal stress and environmental stress that people experience. So that would be something that I often have in my practice. I also see couples a lot. I enjoy couple work, so which also has its own kind of a little incubator of showing you what the distress is about outside in our environments and our communities. So that would be something that would also feature on the one leg of the practice. And then I would do forensic work as well, which is a lot in the family law side of it, where I look a lot at your care and contact assessments, which involves parents in divorce or high conflict divorces usually, and how to determine the best interests of the child and make recommendations that parents can follow. That's, I feel, a very important part of the practice. I think that's a big input you also have in the community and people directing their future a bit better from where they're coming from, and for the children as well. Also mental health and assessments of parents. And yeah, so that was the forensic side. And then I also have but connected to that, the mediation, the divorce and family mediation side, and the parent coordination side, which is the mediation is pre-divorce. So they rather prefer to mediate the divorce than go to a litigation process. And then the parent coordination is a post-divorce intervention. After they've settled, after there's a parenting plan, the parent coordinator is actually set in place to help the parents be better co-parents. So if there's a dispute and they can't make a decision, they rather approach the parent coordinator than run to the attorneys and the courts.
In a lot of the conversations that we've had with your colleagues and even in other disciplines, we've tended to focus on the individual and the self. But hearing some of the dynamics in your work, it's not just about one person. It's about relationships in a couple. It's about relationships in a family setting and how those interactions matter.
So it is extremely important. You cannot separate that from those systems. And I think if you cannot navigate on those levels, you will find it extremely important, or difficult rather, to really kind of face your challenges or become mentally more healthy or stable, and less distressed. So it is very important.
In consideration of the family mediation aspect, you spoke about this being the phase pre-divorce. Do you notice any gender differences in terms of how men versus women approach conflict resolution?
I do, I do. I think, unfortunately, we do see that. It is, I think it's how much that the parties are embedded in very stereotypical gender roles. And that will most certainly make a difference in the way that conflict is negotiated and dealt with and resolved. And when they are very rigid in their gender roles, I do see a lot of disempowerment with women not having their voice, not being able to negotiate as strong and as confident as their partner would if it's a male partner. So I think you unfortunately do still find a lot of that. And it is not just because of that moment of having to resolve something. It comes a long way. You know, it's years of being maybe in a relationship that has been chipping away at self-esteem and courage and self-respect and all these kind of aspects that help to find that you can be empowered, you know, you can be assertive. So it comes a long way, and I do find it most certainly. The voices are very quiet, and the assertiveness is not there, and which is very important that the mediator knows that, you know, and that you can actually allow the space for that person to voice what they need to voice, and not just allow the one person to dictate.
That was going to be my next question on if you're allowed as a mediator and not be completely impartial, but understanding that, you know, everybody needs to contribute in order to get optimal outcomes.
I think you have to. It's not about them being partial. You can even find that it could be the other way around, right? That the female has a lot of strengths and the male doesn't, and he's quiet. But you do need to allow both parties an opportunity to take the stage, an opportunity to voice their concerns or what they want out of the process. And you need to give them that opportunity, and sometimes even encourage it. That's so important. And there's actually quite now a movement towards looking at victims, or when there's domestic violence in a relationship, to still be able to mediate it. But being very aware of that disequilibrium in power, and how you can maybe reestablish some of that in a mediation process.
So, keeping with this stream of thought, you've gone mediation, then you go into, I think, well, before we get to parent coordination, but now you're coming into actual divorce space. What are some of the psychological factors or tools that women can help rebuild their confidence and emotional resilience after divorce if they've been in a kind of disempowering relationship?
I think something to remember to start with is that it is a process. I know that sounds like such old hat, that's always what a psychologist tells you. It's about the process. But there is some merit in it, because I think people can be very impatient and they want to get divorced and go on with their life. But I think certain challenges or certain aspects of being post-divorce and being single, or a divorcee, or whatever the term might be you kind of have in your head, is to really come to terms with it. And you don't always know what you have to come to terms with until you're at the post-divorce stage. And then you have to, then you face your challenges. I think, so first of all, it's to know that it is a process that you're going to go through, and that how building your confidence again is extremely important. Overcoming your fears. There's so many fears, that fears of being alone, fears of not being good enough, being a failure, I won't ever find someone again, or even be able to rebuild your life. And often you don't have a template. That's quite an interesting thing that came up a lot, is that you start off life, as you say, you don't want to, you don't marry to divorce. You kind of marry to stick it out forever. So your template in your head is about married life and the trajectory about having children and aging, or going to certain things in your life together. And so suddenly that whole plan is gone and you have nothing. You don't have a vision. You don't have a picture in your head, and that can bring a lot of fear, and feeling of being lost. So that's something to really work on, to rebuild that.
So slight divergence to our conversation. I remember once giving a focus group, and the women in that focus group were around about age 70, and some of them had recently become widowed with their husbands passing away. And it was like there was a massive identity crisis, because you'd had this partner for years and years and years, and now suddenly they weren't invited to functions. They didn't know what to do with their time. They felt lost and identity piece. And this goes back to your notion of a template. And I often wonder if we have been fed these fairy tales, and that we kind of like anchor towards them, even though life is just not like that.
No, that's not, you're right, we do. We still hold those fairy tales, and suddenly life surprises us by not playing with us, and then we are quite taken aback, and it's quite traumatic, as you say, it very much is. And you also don't know how to define yourself, but also society doesn't help, because you're very right that a lot of the times, and unfortunately, women feel very marginalized when they're a divorcee, because men go out and they find someone and they play the field, and they really, they get kind of a thumbs up there, and they're invited to many, many things so that they can meet someone. But women are not. And it's a very, very interesting stereotype that you can only function when you're in a couple. So you can only have a conversation or contribute when you're a couple. So people don't invite that person anymore because they're not part of a couple. So suddenly they assume that that person loses identity or intelligence or ability to conversate, you know. It's really a big shock, actually.
And it struck me also how one needs to navigate life anyway, that in different experiences or different ages or different life stages, that we don't stop becoming the person we were before, but that we have this kind of like accumulation and evolution.
Absolutely. No, it is. It's a huge adaptation. It's sometimes even a bit of a reinventing yourself in a way, and finding a different place for yourself because the old space is no longer allowing you to be there.
Yeah. Tough world, tough space. How do you help people navigate it?
Are you talking specifically with a divorce now, or the post-divorce, or just in general?
Yes, let's say in general, or you can use specifics if you want to contextualize a particular example.
You know, I think if you do go across the board with different kind of contexts, navigating life is an extremely difficult situation to do or challenge. And I read this interesting clip the other day, which was quite a humorous quote that said that apparently as an adult, you have to be responsible all the time, like every day, like 24/7. Isn't that a bit much, you know? The person asked, and I thought, yes, that's what they don't tell you. That's the T's and C's you don't have when you want to become an adult. So it is extremely challenging a lot of the times. I find something lacking is that self insight. You know, and if you have the self insight a bit on what is going on here inside of me in these situations, that helps a lot. Kind of gives you a little bit of an anchor to work from. If you just roll around with it and you are thrown back and forth like a little boat on the ocean without its anchor, it creates more anxiety, feelings of being overwhelmed and lost. So I find a lot of the times to kind of cultivate that self-insight helps quite a lot to start with, but also seriously a sense of empowerment, you know, even just over your immediate environment or the crisis in some way. You can't control everything. I usually refer to control as, you know, we all know we can't have global control. We do know we want it, but it's just not on the table. So we're going to have to lower our expectations. But some form of control in your environment makes you feel empowered again, you know. And when people realize that there's more around than they can actually control and manage, that gives them a lot of that sense of empowerment, you know, to say, well, sure, I can maybe actually do this. Yeah, and not feeling alone. It's amazing that in our society where we're so connected on every level, we still feel often that it's only us that is suffering this fate or that it is only us that cannot cope. And we should be coping better, and we shouldn't be this weak. Or, but the moment they realize that you're not alone, you are part of a really big group we call humans, and we all feel like this sometimes, and that makes a big difference as well.
Normalizing things.
Absolutely. Yeah, because we always think we should be super everything, and we're not.
Fallibility of
Bad
being
news.
human. Looking towards the child element. So, in your experience, you deal with quite a lot of custody battles. What are some of the most common challenges that mothers face or experience in custody disputes? And do you think there's still bias in the legal system when it comes to awarding custody?
I think there are some challenges. I think unfortunately still a lot are the economic challenges, where women still suffer, even though there is an equality of sorts, having high income, a career path, and having their own place in the career field, in the workforce. It still seems to be quite prevalent that there's economic abuse and financial abuse in these relationships and in a divorce, and that's also why women can't always afford having the best legal representation, because they just don't have the finances, to start off. And if they do, they have to fight very hard for their partner to come to the party, and pay up. Especially when it comes to maintenance and things like that. There's still a lot of struggles around that. And again, women being feeling very disempowered, emotionally they feel they don't have even the right to stand up and fight for what they feel they deserve, and have a voice. They very much would just want to get out of this and just give everything away and just let's just leave this, that the conflict can go away, and they're willing to shoot themselves in the foot without realizing what they're doing really in the long term of things, So yeah, those are definitely challenges that I see still.
That's quite tragic, shooting yourself in the foot because you are so disempowered that you are failing to acknowledge your rights and entitlements in these types of scenarios.
Very. It is really quite mind-boggling that you would think that the time that we live in, that we still actually have a lot of that. And it's sometimes I feel that they're living in their own little kind of bubble, sort of, where there's nothing else that kind of comes through that bubble. It's just their little environment where they are disempowered in, and where they don't realize how much more they can have and be.
One of the things that you raised early in the conversation was about the role of mediators as being able to almost like bring out the quiet voices, ensure that everyone gets heard, and ensure that there is an element of fairness in the process. How are you seeing the legal system evolving in a similar way to better support women in custody disputes or divorce proceedings and parental coordination?
I do think the legal system has kind of really tried and at times succeed to really aid women, and there's a lot of movement and kind of more acts that have been coming in power about maintenance and women, and very strongly coming down on the partner that doesn't want to pay the maintenance, and they really do actually pursue those cases. It's not always easy, and obviously a lot of the cases fall through the cracks, and so we don't have an ideal system at all. But I do think that there is some movement to realize that there's a huge disequilibrium here. There's a huge power disadvantage, and this has to be restored. So there's at least that, and you can see that in the domestic on our acts. That kind of came into being, the Domestic Violence Act that we have. That is an extremely good piece of legislation that it doesn't all, the problem is not that. The problem is often the implementing of it, and the carrying through of it. That's where the thing kind of really sits. But the legislation is there, and so that makes a big difference. That sensitivity needs to be put in place, and how it's implemented. There's the Employment Equity Act that we have as well. There's that Section 9 of the Constitution that talks about all is equal before the law, and that you have equal protection and benefits. So we do have the tools, I would call it. It's really about implementing it in the right way, and consistently, and having people have access to what it can give you. I think that's the important side of it.
It's really positive to hear that the legislation is in place, that it is being adjusted on a continual basis. We've sort of spoken about almost the end points of relationships and kind of like the fallibility aspects and what happens. If we were to go back before the relationship happened, because I always think, you know what, hindsight as being 2020 vision. If you could give people some advice before they get married or before they enter into a relationship up front to protect their well-being down the line if something were to happen or things not work out, what types of things should they look at up front?
I think you, which can often lead to lots of arguments pre-marriage, is to really put the fantasy and the dream life aside and really look at life around us and say, you know, things unfortunately do not always work out the way that we want. And very unfortunately, some marriages do not survive the long haul. And you need to take care of yourself and you need to be very much informed and educated on what your rights are and what you can put in a contract before you get married. So prenatal contract is prenuptial contract is extremely important. And a lot of the times there's not again that empowerment. But I have a right to this. I can say that I want this and this in my contract. I'm not settling for a contract like this. It's not in my best interest. You know, it's really important to take care of yourself. And I think if your soon-to-be spouse is very upset and does not allow even to have that raises a few questions on its own. So I do really think that is something that one has to really take care of, is to have that put in place. And at least you know that if ever it comes to that, you will be more secure. You will be in a much, much stronger position to negotiate as well, different things. I think it was Virginia Woolf that said, a woman must have money of her own and a room of her own. And I love that so much. It's always stuck with me that is the bottom line. You need that anchor. You need that strength and that empowerment.
And if you think about it, we have contracts for everything. When you're talking about having a room, it would be we have a rental contract.
Exactly.
When you talk about money, we have an employment contract. And those are all, you know, aspects that govern that particular relationship. And
absolutely.
This is something that is so fundamental and critical in our life as a life partnership that we should have these contracts in place.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's not even something that you should think twice about. It is just what it is.
What do you think some of the hesitancy is that not as many people have a prenuptial or antenuptial contract?
I think it's about also not wanting to rock the boat, I suppose, you know, upset your partner or to tell, because the person often, again, the stereotypes is, well, don't you trust me or don't you trust in my love for you? You know, all these kind of questions. And so that becomes a bit of a guilt trip as well. And people fall for that, I suppose. And they then don't want to push the issue. You know, and again, I think it's very short-sighted to fall into that trap and buy into those kind of, I want to say propaganda, but I suppose not that bad and that strong. But, yeah, so I think that's possibly why not. And I know I keep harping on it, but I think it's an empowerment issue. I have a right? Should I stand up for myself? Should I ask for these things? So it's a lot about those as well.
We certainly need more education, and I'm not just talking about book smart, but life smart skills.
Yeah, very, very much more.
So moving slightly away from your field, but still staying with aspects of professions and working, one of the challenging aspects that I think on gender equality principles speaks about is the reality of work-life balance. Often we find that women take on a lot more of the unpaid labor, and at that, it means that they sacrifice their careers, or they're expected to lead these double lives and burn themselves out. And one of the variations that I heard to achieving work-life balance, someone spoke about prioritization and delegation, because she said it just there is no balance, it's not possible. So, in terms of your personal experiences as someone who is successful in their career, what are some of your views?
Yeah, there's definitely no balancing everything. You're going to have to sometimes prioritize, and sometimes you're going to have to delegate. And those are two things that very few are very good with, because I think a lot of strong women that are successful kind of have those hidden traits of being perfectionistic and being slightly bit, maybe a bit of a control freak. And so if you mention to them delegating, their left eye starts to twitch and they become very uncomfortable with the idea. So that's a very big challenge, to delegate and to prioritize even, because sometimes everything is important. And you must tend to it immediately. So I think you're going to have to be very strict with yourself, to say no. No is a real word, and I'm sorry, I cannot. So I think that is going to be extremely important. And delegation is really important, you know, and especially I think if you're in a position where you are maybe in a mentor position or a management position, or how are people going to learn how to do things if you cannot let go, and if you cannot allow them to also learn how to. So the delegation is extremely important. I myself battle with that as well, but I mean, it does help if you actually get to do it, you know. But yeah, the balance is not. I don't think you can't have it all, and I think we finally realize that. I think it's still there. I still think it's kind of an unspoken or unwritten contract that you can have your career, you can have all that you want to do, but you also have to be the mom and the wife and the this. And so it's that idea that we must balance it all, and you just can't. I think your end result is burnout.
Very sobering, very true words. And I hope that our collective womanity listenership takes heed of that, that we have to sacrifice some points, aspects, or you can't do them all simultaneously. That's one of the realities.
Absolutely.
Going towards a little bit of a personal aspect, can you tell us about some of the pivotal moments in your life growing up?
Yeah, I think the moments growing up, I was very much blessed, and at an advantage that I had really good parents, or have a good parents still left. And so I was exposed to many amazing things, such as books and reading, and all the things that can make you ask questions and keep your curiosity going. So that was an amazing thing that I was actually allowed to have and exposed to. And I think pivotal moments from there was, I suppose, the fact that I could go and study further. You know, that was huge. That was it wasn't something foreign in our family also, but it was something that one could see as a privilege still, and to make the most of it and to really excel in that, you know, and have the support of my family to do that. And and to really have to know that it can be done. And I think that was a pivotal moment as well for me. And so yeah, and I think the career, my career field is obviously a big part of that as well, to show yourself that you are in some way able to make some things work and achieve some things that you might not have thought was possible.
You've highlighted aspects that have contributed towards your achievement. So, family, education, belief in terms of your capabilities and a purpose. What are some of the other success factors for you?
I think if you look a bit more internally, the factors that contribute to those is to sometimes have the push through in difficult situations, and to sometimes be able to kind of, what is the word, to kind of be able to fend situations that you can tolerate it, that you are, have the ability to maybe bear it and tolerate and get through and believe that you could, that you can handle it and you can get through it. And I think don't believe that at all, that you're ever going to see the end of that light. But by the moment you do get through it, that's a pivotal moment to realize, sure, but maybe I do have some resilience, or I can. I think that is important, you know, to be able to weather some of the storms of it.
Resilience is a really important attribute. And lastly, as we close out today's conversation, can you share a few words of inspiration or wisdom with girls and women who are listening to us?
Sure, you know, I think we have come a long way, but I think there's a lot that we can still achieve and do as women and as girls. And we need to know that our strength is not in us alone. It is in a sisterhood, in a women community. I think it's lacking. I think that your mentorship of older women to the younger girls and women is extremely valuable. It's so good to have that support and seek it out. And for older women to give that back to the younger generation. We've got so much to give. And we can't lose that. We need to give it back, and support and guide. So I think that is extremely important to adhere to that. And seek out your education there. I just cannot think of anything you cannot not have that. It is extremely valuable to have.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for those heartfelt insights. And I love the view of almost the circular economy of life stages and giving back at the end of your life to new lives that are coming through, and the power of education to empower yourself and your community within your ecosystem.
Definitely.
So thank you very much for joining us. It's been a pleasure to host
Thank you
you.
so much. Thank you very much for the opportunity, and thank you for allowing me to also voice a few things.
You have been listening to Womanity, Woman in Unity, and we have been talking to Dr. Ilse van der Merwe, who is a counseling psychologist based in Cape Town, South Africa.